Okay, everyone. So today we're going to have a look at the what is called the Upakilesa Sutta, translated here into English as corruptions. And this word, Upakilesa, is a word that kind of appears in various forms in the sutta. Sometimes it's just called kilesa. Kilesa is a very commonly used these days around the Buddhist world. Sometimes called sankilesa, sometimes called upakilesa, and it basically does variations on a theme referring to corruptions or defilements or impurities of the mind. That's essentially what it comes down to. And so this sutta is, in a sense, a continuation of the previous one. We're going to carry on looking at how to purify the mind. Yeah? So looking at more of these defilements and how to overcome them. And so this is a similar vein as the previous sutta. But it's a very rich sutta. It has a lot of narrative around it, a lot of interesting little details in the sutta. And at the moment, this is one of the suttas I really enjoy because of all the little details and all the kind of small little pointers to how the Dhamma works and how it functions. And of course, it is another one of these suttas that is an autobiographical sutta of the Buddha. It's how the Buddha himself practiced and how he did things. And again, it has that aspect as well. So this word, upakilesa, or kilesa, one of the interesting things that I always note when I study Buddhist texts is how vocabulary gets used differently at different times in Buddhist history, and how things tend to change, and how very often that what we think of as Buddhism is not necessarily the Dhamma or the Buddhism of the Buddha, but it's actually Buddhism from later periods. And sometimes you can see that in the way we talk about things, the kind of words we use to explain the Dhamma. And we often end up using words that were invented a long time after the Buddha. And when we talk about Buddhism, and instead of using the original vocabulary, you get the feeling that we are kind of holding on to what happened at later times. And this is an example of that. The word kilesa, which is commonly used around the Buddhist world, is not really used very much at all in the suttas. It is found maybe, I think there's one sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya 3 where it is used. And apart from that, what we find is upakilesa and sankilesa instead. And the point is not that it makes an enormous amount of difference. It may make a little bit of difference, not an enormous amount. The point is more how we always have a tendency to see Buddhism through the lens of later times. There's a tendency then to read later ideas back into the earlier text. We saw this idea already with Bodhisatta, and we're reading, understanding Bodhisatta in light of later developments rather than seeing it how it is actually used in the suttas. We see this in many different areas coming up again and again and again, how you are actually looking at later developments and reading those back into the suttas of an earlier time. And that's very interesting. It's something to be clear about. This is one example of that. In the suttas, it's always upakilesa, and not really kilesa, sometimes sankilesa. And it does make a little bit of difference because kilesa, the way it is used in the suttas, it is usually used to mean the three root defilements, the three root defilements, often lobha, dosa, moha, often translated as greed, hatred, and delusion, but perhaps better simply as desire, ill will, and confusion, or something like that. But these are the root defilements, and because they are the root defilements, they are very all-encompassing. Everything is included in those root defilements. Whereas upakilesa is used in the suttas in quite a different way. Upakilesa is a reference to the refined defilements of the mind, the things that block you from achieving samadhi specifically. So when you practice these teachings, you go a long way in reducing the The negative qualities that you may have. You may abandon a lot of ill will, abandon a lot of bad things, but there is still a remnant at a certain point of defilements in the mind. Even though you are already purified a long way, there's a remnant, and this remnant of defilements is often called upakilesa. And this is what we're going to see in this particular sutta, how the Buddha to be is practicing, and he's getting samadhi nimittas coming up, and he's getting some good meditation happening, and yet there are these upakilesas in the mind that block him from going further and achieving the jhanas proper and the insights proper from that. So it does make a little bit of difference. And one of the consequences of this as well is that, for example, the five hindrances are called upakilesa in the suttas. Very often when we think of the five hindrances, there's a tendency to think of the five hindrances as a description of all defilements of the mind. Yeah, that all defilements are somehow included in the five hindrances. But that is not how they are used in the suttas. The five hindrances, again, they come at the very end, just before you enter samadhi. That's where it talks about abandoning the five hindrances. Prior to that, you are already purifying your body and speech. You have sense restraint to purify the desire and ill will of the mind. You have contentment to stop yourself from desiring all kind of crazy things in the world. You have sati sampajanya, the situational awareness, or whatever you want to call it. All of these things are geared towards reducing the defilements of the mind. So when you come to the five hindrances, which are quite late in the gradual training here, we mentioned the gradual training last night, Chulahati Padopama Sutta, the shorter discourse on the elephant's footprint, and that has all of these elements, but they come in a sequence. And the five hindrances come late in that sequence, just before you enter samadhi. So the five hindrances is actually really about refined hindrances of the mind. And that's why they are called upakilesas as well. That is an important point to understand what we are dealing with. It is not the coarse things are not really called hindrances. They are too hindering to be called hindrances. They are like, what is a kind of really bad hindrance? Like super blockages or something like that. I don't know what they call them. These are the things that we are dealing with when we talk about the hindrances. So that does matter a little bit to understand the process, how the process works. The Buddha makes it clear other places that if you're going to make progress on the path, you have to know what to abandon when. You have to know what are your biggest problems, what are the big hindrances, what are the big, not using the word hindrance again, what are the big blockages that you have. And you have to focus on things in the right sequence. If you try to remove the refined hindrances when you have some major blockage, it's not going to work. You have to start with the big issues, then moving on to the middling issues, then go to the refined ones. And you have to, otherwise, you're kind of fooling yourself as to how you're making progress on this path. So getting things in the right sequence matters. So here we're going to talk about more of these fairly refined hindrances. So I know that there's many people here who are getting some nice meditation coming up, and that's wonderful, getting happiness and nimittas and these kind of things. That means that this is kind of very suitable for someone who is going well in the meditation practice. That is the word upakilesa, to give you some idea what that refers to. Then let us just dive into this sutta and see what comes of it. So I have heard at one time the Buddha was staying near Kosambi in Gosita's monastery. Kosambi, one of the great cities of ancient India, the six great cities, one of them was Kosambi. Kosambi is one of the few that has actually been archaeologically dug out. So if you go to this area, I've never been there, you can see the kind of the great mounds. Yeah, there were great mounds around the city that were built up out of clay and dirt. And of course, this is pretty much the only thing that remains of these ancient cities. And it gives an idea of the size. And the size is not that impressive. Yeah, a great city in India 2,500 years ago would be considered quite a small town by modern standards. And there you have this fellow Gosita. Gosita, I'm not entirely sure what the story of Gosita is. It is no doubt it is told somewhere in the commentaries, but I don't really know much about that. Donated by someone. And this is where the Buddha was staying at this particular time here. Now at that time, the mendicants of Kosambi were arguing, quarreling, and disputing, continually wounding each other with barbed words. Human beings have always been human beings. They always end up arguing, quarreling, and disputing. That's what human beings do. They are wounding each other with barbed words. The Pali is mukha satehi, and literally means the swords of the mouth. That's kind of a nice expression, isn't it? The swords of the mouth. We're using words to hurt each other. It's kind of and how these things often are. So here you have the monastic sangha arguing. This, of course, happens because monastics are human beings like everyone else, so sometimes you end up arguing. It's not in a good monastery, there will not be much arguing, sometimes if you have very large monasteries with all kinds of monastics coming together, then you may end up sometimes having arguments in that monastery. And what is interesting here is, of course, well, what is the argument about? This is kind of very fascinating because human beings are funny. The kind of things we argue about are sometimes kind of weird. You think surely if the monastics come together, there must be something really important that they argue about. The nature of Nibbana or something like that, or whether someone has committed a parajika offense. A parajika is like a disrobing offense. Something really, really significant. Surely, otherwise they wouldn't argue about anything. About these things, but the reality is, according to the commentary which talks about this, and by the way, this story is found in a number of places in the suttas, found in the Vinayapitaka, it's found here, and so it is kind of an important story, and some of the verses here also found in the Dhammapada. According to the story, the reason they were arguing was because a monk, he had been using the toilet, and after using the toilet, he had left some water in a pitcher. And in this pitcher there was water left, and that was the cause of the argument, because you're not, according to some monks, you're not supposed to leave that water in the pitcher. According to other monks, it was acceptable to leave water in the pitcher. So there was kind of disagreement about that, and that led to this enormous argument in the Sangha. And this is how it often is, right? It often is like that. Small things that actually are completely irrelevant, they lead to the arguments. And the big issues, well, they are kind of too big. You don't even dare touch those sometimes. And this is kind of human nature. It's kind of worth remembering that. Just kind of forget about those little things in life, because actually they don't really matter. It's kind of irrelevant. Who cares if you leave water in that pitcher or not? It's kind of completely irrelevant. And certainly not make an argument out of it. And very often there are underlying issues that lead to little things kind of becoming the straw that breaks the camel's back, right? It's like there's already a camel there. There's already a big problem there. And the camel's back is already very weak. And that's why that last little straw happens. So you want to diffuse things before it is too late. You want to make sure that you always have a sense of metta and compassion. You don't allow the resentment and the ill will and anger to build up until one last straw is enough to kind of break everything apart, and the camel collapses as a consequence. And this is the reason why you want to always make sure that your mind is pure, so you don't build up these negative things in this particular way. But it's fascinating how this is always kind of the human reality, how we end up being really silly, and then we are doing all kind of stupid things as a consequence. Then a mendicant went up to the Buddha, bowed, stood to one side, and told him what was happening, adding, "Please, sir, go to those mendicants out of compassion." And the Buddha consented in silence. This is a kind of a standard way of asking the Buddha to do something. Please do things out of compassion. because this is really the motivation of the Buddha. The Buddha does things always out of compassion because he wants to help people. So this is the right way to ask. Yeah, this is the right way to understand things. And this is kind of useful to remember if you want to ask, you know, someone like Ajahn Brahm, you can ask him in this way, please do it out of compassion. I've seen people do that actually. Usually this is the sort of thing that will make Ajahn Brahm do things because he does things because he wants to be of assistance. His life is really about assisting. It's about teaching and explaining the Dhamma. And so if you ask in this way, that will actually motivate him to act. The Buddha doesn't really have any other motivation. So if the Buddha, if Ajahn Brahm feels that you're trying to kind of manipulate him or whatever, then he's not going to do it regardless. Then there's no way you're going to be able to get him to do anything here. But if you really are sincere, coming out of compassion, then it is likely to happen. Anyway, the Buddha consents in silence. Then the Buddha went up to those mendicants and said, enough, mendicants, stop arguing, quarreling, and disputing. Yeah. So how would you feel if you were arguing with someone and then the Buddha comes to you and says, stop arguing, enough. What would you do? Would you kind of say, yes, sir? Or would you say, I don't want to listen to you? How would you feel if the Buddha came up to you? Imagine you're arguing with someone, the Buddha comes and says, please stop, enough of this arguing. How would you feel about that? Would you kind of say, I couldn't care less, or would you, what do you do? And this again, this says something about how we think about the Buddha and how they thought about the Buddha. Because what is really interesting here is how they react to this when the Buddha says this. This is very fascinating. Because if I think about the Buddha and I can imagine the Buddha coming to me and I'm arguing with Venerable Ananda, for example, that Ananda, no, don't eat that for breakfast, eat this for breakfast or whatever. I never argue with Venerable Ananda, but if in case we were arguing with each other, right? And the Buddha comes and says, please stop. Or even if Ajahn Brahm comes and says, please stop. And especially the Buddha, how would that feel? I think what happens is that because of our idea of the Buddha is so kind of elevated, it's like the idea of not listening to the Buddha is almost impossible. Yeah, of course you're going to listen to the Buddha. That's what he says. You're just going to shut up straight away, pretty much. And again, this shows us the way that we relate to the Buddha in the present day is quite different from the way they related to the Buddha. And it shows us the Buddha in those days, he was basically a human being among human beings. And so the monks, as we shall see in a second, actually relates to the Buddha in a very kind of human, a very ordinary way, and you'll be surprised. So this is what they say when the Buddha says this. Enough, mendicants, stop arguing, quarreling, disputing. And what do they reply? Well, when he said this, one of the mendicants said to the Buddha, wait, sir, let the Buddha, the Lord of the Dhamma, remain passive, dwelling in blissful meditation in the present life. We will be known for this arguing, quarreling, and disputing. Kind of amazing, isn't it? It's kind of almost, what are you, who are you talking to? Is this the Buddha or is it kind of your neighbor or what is it? And it's rude, right? It's outrightly rude. You're kind of dismissing the Buddha and say, oh yeah, please just go and meditate. Yeah, we will do this. We will look after this. That's basically what they are saying. Yeah. And it shows you, again, this feeling that the way that they related to the Buddha, they related to the Buddha as a fairly ordinary human being. Yeah, yeah, he wasn't really anything extraordinary in those days. He wasn't like God or anything like that. Very interesting, again, because it says something about how we shouldn't relate to the Buddha like this, but how we should think about the Buddha again. Yeah, it brings us this back. The humanity of the Buddha comes out in the suttas very powerfully when you read a little carefully about what actually is going on. Anyway, I just like to make these points because it is a very big problem in Buddhism that we tend to misunderstand what the Buddha is. And by making the Buddha too distant, we actually... it stops us sometimes from you know, doing the Buddha Anusati, the recollection of the Buddha, and these things in the right way, and it actually causes problems for us as a consequence. For a second time and a third time, the Buddha said to those mendicants, enough mendicants, stop arguing, quarreling, and disputing. For a third time, that mendicant said to the Buddha, wait, sir, let the Buddha, the Lord of the Dhamma, remain passive, dwelling in blissful meditation in the present life. We will be known for this arguing, quarreling, and disputing. Then the Buddha robed up in the morning, and taking his golden robe, he entered Kosambi for alms. After the meal, on his return from alms round, he set his lodgings, or his, in other words, his kuti in order, or whatever. Taking his golden robe, he recited these verses while standing right there. So setting his lodgings in order, what that means is that he is kind of is about to depart. That's what you do when you depart. Yeah, you kind of organize your lodging, and then you leave. So this means the Buddha is about to leave. That's what it means. And so the answer is that if there's nothing you can do, and the monks are not going to listen to you, what you do? You leave. Yeah, you go, because there's no kind of point in being there anymore if no one is going to listen to you. And that's kind of always powerful, right? Because even though they may have been rude towards the Buddha, obviously they also respect him enormously at the same time. It's weird how you have these things. And if the Buddha leaves, it kind of leaves an impact, imprint on your mind, and it makes you often rethink things a little bit. So sometimes just going can be a powerful response to this kind of situation. And then the Buddha recites these verses, and these verses are very famous verses. They occur here, they occur in the Vinaya Pitaka, they occur in the Dhammapada, so in a number of different places, and they are very, very well known. Some of the most famous verses in the Pali Canon are found right here, and you will recognize them as we go along, I'm sure, at least those of you who have been around for a while, will see what we're talking about. So I'll read through them, and then we will discuss them in a little bit of detail, because they are quite interesting verses. When many voices shout at once, no one thinks that they're a fool. While the Sangha is being split, no one thought another to be better. Dolts pretending to be astute, they talk their words right out of bounds. They blab at will, their mouth agape, and no one knows what leads them on. They abused me, they hit me, they beat me, they robbed me. For those who bear such a grudge, hatred never ends. They abused me, they hit me, they beat me, they robbed me. For those who bear no such grudge, hatred has an end. For never is hatred settled by hate. It is only settled by love. This is an eternal truth. Others don't understand that here we need to be restrained. But those who do understand this, being clever, settle their conflicts. Breakers of bones and takers of life, thieves of cattle, horses, wealth, those who plunder the nation, even they can come together, so why on earth can't you? If you find an alert companion, a wise and virtuous friend, then overcoming all adversities, wander with them joyful and mindful. If you find no alert companion, no wise and virtuous friend, then like a king who flees his conquered realm, wander alone like a tusker in the wilds. It is better to wander alone. There is no fellowship with fools. Wander alone and do no wrong, at ease like a tusker in the wilds. So these are these famous verses. It starts off with the Buddha talking about, obviously this is a reference to the monks in Kosambi who are all shouting at once, together. When many voices shout at once and no one thinks that they're a fool, it's like we have this mass, you know, when you are together with a large group of people, everyone gets affected by everyone else, and no one is really able to think independently. We think like everyone, and because everyone is kind of making a lot out of this water pitcher with water in it, we also think this is really important, to get this sorted out. And what? Water in the pitcher? This is bad. This is really evil. And then you want to, you have to kind of argue about it. This is a problem in the world, this idea of people getting together, thinking like everyone else. We're not really independent enough in the way we think about things. It's so important to stand back and to ask ourselves, so what actually is going on? First and foremost, the most important thing is to be independent when it comes to morality, and do the right thing, and not allow ourselves to be led by the crowds, such as in this case, thinking in the right way about what actually is of value and what is not. But it is also very important when it comes to reflecting on what is really valuable in the world. What are the right teachings? Who are the good teachers? What should we follow? And not to kind of always follow the crowd, but again, to think independently and to trust our own judgment. Very often we cannot trust the judgment of the crowd, but we choose that crowd, right? So in the end, we're also still using our own judgment, if you like, because you have no choice. In the end, you have to decide which crowd you're going to follow. Are you going to follow the Christian crowd, the Buddhist crowd, the Muslim crowd, the Hindu crowd, the atheist crowd, or what are you going to do? You're choosing your crowd regardless. So because of that, following the crowd blindly is always a very bad idea. It's important to think for yourself. It's important to trust your own judgment. And then you can be on the right track. And this is difficult for us as human beings because we are social animals. It's important to us, the connection that we have to others, and so this ability to stand alone and to see things independently is actually quite hard. But sometimes you have no choice but to do that. This is one of the things that has always inspired me by those people who have practiced really well, whose meditation is very profound, who have a lot of insight, those people who seem solid in the Dhamma, is their independence, their ability to go their own way, and to say, well, actually the whole world, if they go to the left, I will still go to the right. And the whole world does go to the left, and then they go to the right. And then they say, oh yeah, I'm just doing what is right. I remember, this is one of those things that you see sometimes. And I remember when I always come back to this bhikkhuni ordination that we did back in 2009, because that was very interesting in this particular respect. And after we did that ordination, Ajahn Brahm was kind of summoned to Thailand, to Wat Pa Pong, and to sort of to discuss the matter, or to, you know. And then Ajahn Brahm came back from that meeting, and when he came back, he asked himself, it was quite difficult in many ways, but then he said to me that the only thing I really asked myself was, did I do anything wrong? And then he came to the conclusion, I didn't do anything wrong, and so because of that he could just shrug his shoulders and carry on, and it wasn't such a big deal. And that's kind of extraordinary, because these were his friends in the monastic world, and he was basically rejected and thrown out, and he just kind of, okay, that's kind of life. Okay, life goes on. I didn't do anything wrong, so it's no issue. And that is the right way of thinking about this. Having that sense of complete independence, being able to do what is right because you know something is right, and not because of whatever the crowd might say. This is the kind of degree of independence that ideally one should have. So no one thinks they are a fool, even though the Sangha is being split, and obviously that's a very bad idea. People don't really see how bad it is, and they are incapable of seeing things clearly. None thought another to be better. In other words, you don't have any perspective on your own actions, and you don't see when you go wrong, and that actually there might be an alternative path which is better. Dolts pretending to be astute, they talk the words right out of bounds. Yeah, you lose all kind of perspective on what is going on. They blab at will, the mouths agape. No one knows what leads them on. Yeah, you are led by the crowd. You are led by your defilements. You are led by not really understanding what is happening. You're not really using yoniso manasikara, the wise reflection, to see the root of what is driving you. And instead of seeing that root, instead of seeing the problem, instead of understanding that what you're doing is wrong, you're just driven by the crowd, driven by your own kind of a lack of insight into what is happening here. And so this is what the Buddha is referring to here, referring to these monks. And now come these very interesting words or verses that are very, very famous. And so they go as follows. They abused me, they hit me, they beat me, they robbed me. For those who bear such a grudge, hatred never ends. They abused me, they hit me, they beat me, they robbed me. For those who bear no such grudge, hatred has an end. And so what is very interesting about these verses is that you will notice here that they abused me, they hit me, they beat me, they robbed me. That is what you can expect in the world. Right? The difference here is not whether you get abused or not. The difference is not whether you get hit or robbed or not. Everyone gets robbed sometimes. Everyone gets abused sometimes. That is a given. That is what we can expect in the world. What the difference is not that. The difference is how we react to those things. That is the difference. And too often in life, we get these things completely wrong. What we try to do, we try to avoid the abuse. We try to avoid the theft, someone robbing our home or whatever. We try to avoid being hit even. Sometimes we might even get hit. All of these things, we try to avoid them. But these are givens in life. We can expect those things. Hardly a day goes by in ordinary life without someone saying something that is unpleasant. Yeah, there's always unpleasantries going on. There's always things that are not very nice. This is the way of the world. And this is already a very powerful insight. Because the moment you understand that this is the way the world works, you stop fighting it. You stop trying to find a way out. And you start to accept the nature of the world. So if someone abuses you, you kind of shrug your shoulders. I expected that. And this kind of you. And you carry on. And you're not too worried about it. And this is already a beautiful insight because it means that we look for the solution in the right place and not in the wrong place. The solution is not in avoiding these things. Of course, sometimes avoiding these things is fine and sometimes you can, but it's the complete avoidance of these things is impossible. And so the solution instead is in our reaction, right? It is actually in not thinking like that. Yes, people may abuse, may use abuse, but you don't actually think of it as you being abused and they being bad. Instead, you shrug your shoulders and you understand this is the nature of the world. But this is the answer. The answer is an acceptance of those things that you cannot do anything about. And there are many things in the world we cannot do anything about. And you will notice every time you say, oh no, every time you say, no, this is happening, this is bad, there's a war in Ukraine, there is a tsunami in Sumatra, there is all of these things happening in the world. And if you find yourself reacting badly, it is precisely because you haven't really accepted the nature of the world. And this is kind of the big problem here. So how can we accept this? This then becomes the very important point. How can we, someone abuses you, and how can you deal with that in a skillful way? And this becomes incredibly important, and this is really how you overcome ill will, you overcome all the negativity to the world around you, by reflecting on these things in the right way. So what is the right way? And what is the right way is basically to understand that, and we talked about this before, but it's such an important point. And this will transform, if you use these simple ideas in the right way, it will transform your life. And you start really to think about people in an entirely different way. And this again is to understand how we are conditioned. how we are created, who we are, our personality, the way we live our life is created by the past. Past lives, the upbringing in this life, all the things that we have experienced, they come together and they shape you in the present moment. The person you are right now is the sum total of your past conditioning. That past conditioning comes from outside and it also comes from within, but ultimately comes from outside. And we are created to be who we are. So when someone does something bad, why do they do that bad thing? Well, basically because of conditioning. They don't have much choice in doing those bad things. They do it as a result of all of these forces working on them. And this is what I was saying before, in a very real sense of the word. They are a victim. They are a victim of that conditioning. And they don't have much choice. And the moment you see someone who you previously saw as a perpetrator of bad things, of evil things, the moment you understand that, yes, in one way they are a perpetrator, but in an equal way they are also a victim. They are a perpetrator because they are a victim, because they are made to do those things by the conditioning coming from the past, and they don't have much choice. And the moment you see that, you start to have compassion for those people in the world who seem evil, who seem bad. It's very powerful. Yeah, these things are really, really powerful ideas, and they can change your entire outlook so fast. But remember, it takes time, right? It doesn't happen overnight. You need to kind of reflect on these things again and again. And as you do that, your mind is reconditioned and your super tanker is kind of starting to move in a different direction. The momentum of the past starts to reduce, and then you have the ability to head in a different direction as a consequence. So this is how to think about these things. The reason why we often get so upset about other people and the way they treat us is because we take things personally, right? They are doing things against me. Me, me, me. It's all about me all the time. And that's why we become so upset. And it's natural. I'm not saying that that is bad or anything like that. Of course, we are concerned about ourselves. Everyone is concerned about themselves. It is natural we are closest to ourselves. And of course, we are concerned about that. But nevertheless, it is about me. It is this kind of worldview of self-focus, of self-interest. And that is the issue. But the reality is, actually got nothing to do with you. And this is kind of the interesting thing. Even if someone is shouting in your face and telling you that you are a terrible person, that you are bad or whatever, still, actually, it's got nothing to do with you. It has everything to do with the other person. They are the ones who are conditioned in this moment to act in this particular way. You happen to be there, and you have to bear the difficulty of having to face that person. But actually, it's got nothing really to do with you. It has everything to do with the other person. If that person had been conditioned in a different way, they would have reacted differently. If that person was the Buddha, they would never shout at you. It's a different kind of conditioning. So it's got nothing to do with you. It's got everything to do with the other person. And that is the important point to remember. And the moment you take the personal out of these things, at that moment, it doesn't matter so much anymore. Right? If you see someone behave really badly in the world, but it's not towards you, it's towards someone else. It's a very different feeling, right? If someone is shouting at you, okay, it's kind of unpleasant. But if someone is shouting at someone else, if someone is shouting at Venerable Ananda, I think, well, it's not nice, but I don't take it as seriously as if it is shouting at me. Sorry, Venerable, I apologize. But if they are shouting at a complete stranger, it's even less important, right? So then the kind of matters even less. And you may not like it, but it's not as confronting as if it has to do with you. It's much easier to see the situation with compassion when you are more distant from things. And this is the idea. So you start to understand things in a different way. And the moment you see that person who is behaving badly, who is shouting at you or doing the wrong thing or whatever, the moment you see that person as a victim of the conditioning, compassion arises. Yeah, that moment, you feel the sense of, wow, they are destroying their own future. They are making bad karma. They are maybe getting reborn in the bad place because of the terrible behavior. They have no idea what they are doing to themselves. And instead of thinking about yourself, you are looking at that person with compassion instead, because you understand they are the one who have the problem. You just have to bear it for a few moments, then you can walk off and you're fine. They are the one who have the real issue. And this is such a beautiful thing, because in one moment you have a self-concern, you have a self-interest, and you are kind of focusing on me. And the me feeling is a very narrow, small feeling. It's like me against the world, and the world seems scary because you're looking at yourself and kind of you against everyone around you. And then from one fraction of a second, by changing your perception of what is going on, instead of seeing yourself against the world in this way and the world seeming like a scary place and having the self-concern, you turn it around and you have compassion for the other person. And at that moment, your mind expands out. Yeah, because compassion is an expansive feeling. It encompasses other people. Instead of seeing a barrier and a kind of a something between you and others, you take that barrier away, and then you feel this openness of the mind, and it kind of, the mind opens up to the world instead. It's a beautiful shift in perspective. Yeah, and that is all it takes, is a slightly different way of looking at the world, of perceiving reality, and then the whole situation changes dramatically as a consequence. Very simple ideas. And this is what you are seeing in these verses. Abuse is inevitable. Being robbed, unfortunately too, is sometimes inevitable. Even being beat and hit is sometimes inevitable. But how we react to these things is not inevitable. You can either think like that or you don't think like that. And that is the whole difference. In one case, you're taking it personally. In the other case, you know that actually the problem is not yours. The problem is with the other person. So this is how to reflect on these things. And these are very, very powerful ideas. And it's not. This is not just coming from me. I'm actually basing this on this sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya called the Agatapativinaya Sutta, which means the overcoming of resentment or ill will. It is the Anguttara Nikaya 562. I know that someone here was very sad that we didn't do that sutta. So now we can print it out, and then everyone can have a look at it. So that's, now, once I mention it, it has to be printed out. Isn't that how it works? So, so that's good. So we are. Thereby, I am forcing the printing out of that sutta by mentioning it in this way. So this is how this works, and it's the ideas from that sutta that I'm using and expanding a little bit on when I talk about this. That is the idea. There's lots more to be said about overcoming ill will, but let's just leave it at that for now. We can always come back to these things later on if necessary. And then you have this other very famous verse, For never is hatred settled by hate. It is only settled by love. This is an eternal truth. Hatred is never settled by hatred. If you get angry with the angry person, if you hate back at someone who hates, you are just perpetuating the problem. It carries on from one generation to the next one. And human beings, we are masters at carrying grudges from the past. This is what we do. You did this to my family, my parents. You did this to my grandparents. Your tribe invaded my tribe 500 years ago. We remember it. We have carried the grudge down through the generations, and I will remind my children of that grudge so to ensure that it doesn't cease. And sometimes one of the most amazing things I remember reading, and this was, I think, when the, when was this? Maybe when the, was it when the Americans were in Afghanistan or the British were in Afghanistan or something, like, I can't remember when it was, but it's kind of in fairly recent times. And the Afghanis were saying, yeah, it's, nothing ever changes. This is just like Alexander the Great when he invaded Afghanistan 2,300 years ago, right? Nothing has changed. We remember that. We still have a grudge because of that. And now we are kind of unhappy. Same kind of people coming from the West, yeah? Alexander the Great, British, Americans, it's all the same, yeah? Coming from the Western world and invading Afghanistan. And I find that so amazing. And when you read the history of people around the world, there's so much of that kind of stuff, yeah? The carrying of the grudges from the past. So you carry on. The wars always roll on. There is no forgiveness. Yeah, the forgiveness is for fools, according to some of these people. And then things kind of move on. Hatred leads to more hatred. So this is the problem in the world, right? When we kind of remember these things from the past instead of just understanding what is going on. And understanding what is going on just means that, okay, this is the nature of the human realm. Shrug your shoulders, nothing personal. Everything is highly impersonal according to Buddhism. And then you kind of let it be, and you let the past be where it belongs, which is on the scrap heap or the rubbish heap or whatever you want to call it, because there's nothing there really worth holding on to. So it is settled by love, it says it. Love is literally non-hatred is the Pali word, really. So I guess you can call that love if you wish. This is an eternal truth. And we know how this works. It's very powerful to meet violence and hatred with kindness. Yeah, it is very, very powerful, especially if it has to be genuine, not pretend kindness, but real kindness, a real sense of concern. It is very, very, very powerful and very difficult to sustain that anger in the face of someone who is truly kind and truly caring. If someone feels that you have compassion for them, it's very difficult to hate that person. And very often what happens if you are cool when someone else is abusing you is that they start to feel a bit self-conscious. They say, maybe I have the problem, right? What's going on here? And they start to actually see themselves in a different way. So in a sense, you are helping the other person as well because they get more perspective on what they are doing when you kind of react in a cool way and you don't kind of get taken in by that hatred. This is... These verses are really powerful, and they have to do with the very kind of foundations of the Buddhist path, how to think about the world in a new way. This is in many ways part of the idea of right view, understanding that human beings, we don't have much ability to do autonomous decisions where we decide that I am going to do this or that. We are more like robots running on programs from the past. That is what we really are like. Why is it so hard to see that? And this is a very important point of Dhamma as well. The reason why it is so hard to see that we are more like robots and we are more running on programs, the reason is because it feels like we have autonomous decisions, right? This is the problem. And because it feels like that, we tend to assume that that is the reality. So we assume that other people are making autonomous decisions, that we are doing that, and for that reason we are responsible because of that. Yeah, and but that feeling, of course, that is the whole point of the teaching of non-self, is that that feeling is itself an illusion. And initially, when we start out on the Buddhist path, we kind of have to accept that. We don't really see it. It still feels like we are autonomous. But as we start to investigate this, and as we start to look into our own reality and how we have been formed by the past, it starts to become quite clear that this must be the case. Actually, we are all kind of railroaded down a certain track by our past conditioning, and that we have very little autonomy, very little kind of say in this. Perhaps we have no say at all. This may be hard to see, but down the track we may start to become more clear about this. So this is the problem. So we need to challenge that sense of independence, autonomy within us a little bit. And as you challenge that, it becomes more easy to forgive yourself. This is also one of the reasons how forgiveness comes about. Forgiveness comes about by understanding that actually, how much choice did you really have? How much was conditioning here? Yeah, and the more you see that conditioning within yourself, the more forgiveness you will have for yourself for all the little mistakes that you have made. Everyone has made mistakes in their life. That's kind of a given. But what is not a given is the degree to which we are able to forgive ourselves or not. And it's very freeing, very liberating. One of the reasons why they say that when you become a stream enter, when you see the Dhamma fully, that you cannot be reborn in a bad realm, is because you have seen non-self. You understand that actually you are a product of conditioning. So how can you possibly judge yourself harshly when you know from direct insight that you are a product of conditioning? You always will be able to forgive yourself. Even if you are Angulimala, the famous Angulimala, Anguli is finger, mala is garland, so finger garland, that was his name. And he was wearing all the fingers of all the people he had killed around his neck. It's pretty kind of a gruesome thing, but anyway, that's what he did. He had killed lots of people, and yet somehow he became fully enlightened. And obviously that's because he was able to forgive himself, able to let go of even the most terrible crimes that he did. So if he can forgive himself for killing other people, then surely we can forgive ourselves for the far lesser crimes and stupid things that we have done. Yeah. And so remember that. You are not as responsible as you think you are. Perhaps you have no responsibility at all. And sometimes people think that this goes against the idea of karma, because surely karma means that you are responsible, right? You do a bad act and then you have bad results. But not necessarily, because the idea of karma is just that you have a bad intention. There are intentions, right? We all have aims and intentions and purposes. The question is whether that intention is you making it or it's just causes creating these particular intentions. So the idea of karma is that when there is an intention, it has results. But karma doesn't say anything about where the intention comes from, whether it is from an autonomous being or just conditions coming together. So the unfortunate thing is that intentions have results, and whether you are responsible for them or not is not the issue. The issue is simply that they have results. And once you know that, that becomes another cause in your path, then to make you think differently, because you are wise, you're looking at things carefully, that becomes another condition that then makes you act in a different way. Sometimes people think that, if there is no self, there's no agents, behind this, then I can just kind of lie down in bed and do nothing. But that's also wrong. That's just another condition, right? And it makes you lie down in bed. That's the wrong way of thinking about it. That's not what it means at all. What it means, rather, is the exact opposite. It means that you have to be really careful. And once you start to get an insight into how conditioned you are, actually it makes you want to practice more, because you understand how dangerous it is. In your next life, you may have no perspective on what is going on. And when you have no perspective, you will be trapped by your conditioning again. And seeing that danger actually makes you, gives you a sense of urgency. I've got to get out of this. This is kind of scary, that I am so much a product of my conditioning in this life, future lives, whenever. All right. So let's have a quick look at the last few verses in this sutta. Others don't understand that here we need to be restrained, but those who understand this, being clever, settle their conflicts. We need to be restrained. There's no point in hating back. It's much better to be compassionate and then restrain yourself and not get involved in these conflicts. So you hold back. When you see conflicts in other people, you stand back and you allow things to be. And then comes the kind of heartfelt expression by the Buddha, the breakers of bones, the takers of life, the thieves of cattle, horses and wealth, those who plunder the nation, even they can come together, so why on earth can't you? So the Buddha is a bit exasperated by his monks. What are you doing? And then he says, if you find an alert companion, a wise and virtuous friend, then overcome all adversities, wander with them joyful and mindful. And so the alert companion, the wise and virtuous friend, this is like the Kalyanamitta. And if you do find the Kalyanamitta in your life, yeah, like people here on this retreat, like all the good people in the world, then you can, you know, it's good to be with such people, especially if they are wiser than you are. It's very good to be with them because they will kind of lead you in the right way. And that's why on retreats like this, this is why we hang out with the Buddha. This is a kind of the idea of these retreats. Actually, we should maybe have that as a title of the retreat, Hanging Out with the Buddha. That's a nice title for a retreat. Because this is the idea of reading the suttas. It's really being in the presence of the Buddha. We're hanging out with a higher kind of wisdom. So when someone is wiser than you, it's good to hang out with them. That is why I like to hang out with Ajahn Brahm, but Ajahn Brahm doesn't like to hang out with me. This is a problem, right? So this is always the problem. So you're kind of clinging on. There is a nice place in the suttas. This is in the Vanapata Sutta, the Majjhima Nikaya 17, where it says that if you are progressing in the Dhamma and your mindfulness is getting established and your samadhi is getting established and you are growing in the Dhamma, you're heading in the right direction, it says that. And that's the purpose of this life, is to grow in good qualities, be on the right track. And then it says, even if you are asked to leave, you shouldn't leave. That's kind of really interesting, isn't it? So Ajahn Brahm tells me, Brahmali, we had enough of you, time for you to go, right? Now you go overseas, please disappear, go to Russia or Siberia or something like that. And if Ajahn Brahm says that, I'm going to decline. I'm going to say, absolutely no, the Buddha said in the Vanapata, stay, even if you're told to leave, stay, don't go anywhere. And of course, the reason why it says that is because you are doing what the monastic life is supposed to do. You are having success in the monastic life, and that's why you should stay where you are. You shouldn't go anywhere else. Yeah, and so you should stay on because you are fulfilling the purposes of the monastic life. And so then you stay a bit longer, and you're hoping that Ajahn Brahm might change his mind down the track, and say, okay, you can stay after all. So it's kind of fascinating how far it goes. If you are having success, things are going the right way, you should go a long way to carry on like that. So hang out with the wise and virtuous. That is how we grow. Remember this idea that Kalyanamitta, good spiritual friendship, is not 50% of the holy life. Can't be 50%. 50% is way too much, right? Because there is virtue, there is kindness, generosity, wisdom. Kalyanamitta is just one of these factors. Those of you who have been on my retreat before, you know exactly what is going on. But those of you who are not, this is for you, not for anyone else. So how can good spiritual friendship, 50% the Buddha must be an exaggeration here, right? This is Venerable Ananda speaking to the Buddha. And Venerable Ananda said, it's 50% of the spiritual life. And then the Buddha is going to reply to that, and surely the Buddha is going to say, no, you are exaggerating, and please be realistic about this. There are all of these factors on the path. But of course, this is not what the Buddha says. And the very interesting thing is that the Buddha says, don't say so, Ananda, don't say so. Spiritual friendship, good spiritual friendship, is 100% of the spiritual life. And that kind of comes as a surprise, when we hear this. How can spiritual friendship be 100% of the spirit? Do you mean that just by hanging out with Ajahn Brahm and doing everything I need to do, all I have to do is kind of bother Ajahn Brahm every day and then that's kind of you're in business? Or hanging out with the Buddha by reading the suttas, is that it? And the answer is that the whole spiritual path, the practice of the Dhamma, begins by hearing about the Dhamma. It begins with the Buddha making the Dhamma available in the world. And if the Dhamma is not available, you don't even get started on the spiritual path. So that spiritual friendship, those teachings from the Buddha, are required for you even to begin, because that is the right view at the beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path that makes the Noble Eightfold Path unfold. It doesn't unfold without right view at the beginning, and that right view initially comes from the Buddha. It comes from the Kalyanamittas. And for this reason, it is 100% of the spiritual life. And everything develops from that. You hear the word of the Buddha, then you get a degree of faith and confidence, then you start to live accordingly, and then it develops, until eventually you come to the very end of the path. You come to liberation and insight, liberation and understanding. So this is what he's saying here. So find that good spiritual companion, then you are on the right track. But if you find no alert companion, no wise and virtuous friend, then like a king who flees his conquered realm, wander alone like a tusker in the wilds. When you are a king and your country gets invaded and it gets taken over by someone else, well, you have to flee. In the same way, it's like your personal space gets invaded by people who are papamitta. Papamitta is the opposite of the Kalyanamitta. There's good friends and bad friends. And when your personal space gets invaded by the bad friends, you have to flee. You have to go somewhere else. Because the reality is that you will get conditioned by those friends. And they will lead you astray. And you will have a problem as a consequence. So you don't want to hang out with those people. It is better to wander alone. There is no fellowship with fools. Wander alone and do no wrong, at ease like a tusker in the wilds. Okay, so there you are. That is the beginning of this beautiful Kosambi Sutta. That is all for this morning. Please again have a nice lunch, and then we'll come back again at 3:00 this afternoon.